Shooting it raw?
Yes. Shooting it raw.
Well, photography would be among the top five things in my life, I think. Photography, writing, our kids, music, and place in the largest sense, I think. And photography has been in my life for a long time. Like I grew up on a small farm in Saskatchewan, on the prairies of Canada. And an early Christmas gift I got from my parents was a camera. And I guess they knew me better than I knew myself, because sure enough, I turned out to really, really love taking photographs. This was long before digital cameras, of course. So I had to take pictures. And then because we were on a farm, I had to mail them away, and, you know, it would take 3 weeks for them to come back. And then when I got them back, you know, I would study them and I'd figure out what worked, what didn't work. And I loved doing that. I mean, I still have photographs from that long ago. And I loved taking photographs of the sky and of the landscape. I don't know if you've ever been out to the prairies of Canada, but they are flat and majestic and bleak in the winter. You know, they change so much. I just loved taking photographs of it. I think it connects to my very long-standing interest in memory. And I don't just mean that, you know, we all think about our memories, but, you know, it's fascinated me when I was teaching English literature courses at a university. I designed a course called Literature and Memory, or something like that. And, you know, it was all about texts that have a particular connection to memory. You know, Proust's In Remembrance of Things Past, things like that. There's another really interesting short story by Borges called Funes the Memorius, which is about a man who has an incredible memory, and so much so that he can't generalize. He's never been able to generalize. And it becomes a problem for him because everything that he experiences becomes like a distinct event. So those kinds of things have always fascinated me. And photography is a way of kind of capturing memory, but in another way, making us realize how distorted our memories can become. You know, because maybe I don't look at a photograph for a number of years, and then I finally do, and I go, oh, that's not how I was remembering it, you know. At the same time, a photograph isn't just an accurate portrayal of reality either. You know, it depends on the camera lens and the lighting and framing and so many things like that. More and more about how one edits the photographs after one takes it. And of course, with things like DALL-E, you know, the artificial intelligence, that's changing things even more so. So yeah, I guess to go back to what I was saying at the beginning, photography is really, really, really important to me. I can't imagine having a life in which I didn't do that daily. In fact, today I forgot to bring my camera with me to work. And there were so many things along the way that I thought, oh, I wish I had my camera. I want to take a picture of this or that.
Okay. Oh man, I love it. Mark Morton, you know, the train came in. Mark Morton came in, and I love it. I love it. Look, big breath. Thank you for joining me on the podcast. I love how everybody answers the question a little differently. Everybody has a different relationship. We're just meeting for the first time. I did not research you. I did not look at the photographs. We're just meeting. Mark Morton, you're Canadian.
Yeah.
I'm Canadian. I'm from Montreal. Where are you right now?
Right now I'm in Kitchener, which is about an hour outside of Toronto.
Yep, exactly. Okay. So I've been to Kitchener. I have not been. You started speaking about the prairies and the big sky and the landscape, and I haven't been. But that's what I know, right? I know about that part of the place. And there's something really comforting in, you know, in how you speak, in your accent, in the cadence of your words and all this stuff. It's like, come on, brother. Look, listen, we only have an hour. It's going to go by really quickly. Yeah. And I want to get to your photo.
Sure.
So should we go into your first photo?
Yeah. Which do you have them in a particular order or just?
Well, I have them in my folder, and I'm looking at them now. So the first one is. Okay, so it's a photo of, it's a beautiful shot of four kids and a very young looking mother, maybe.
Okay.
It's an outdoor shot. It's a beautiful portrait of, there's a boy. Well, first of all, the mother's in the middle.
Yeah.
I guess, I'm assuming she's a mother.
Yeah, that's right.
Holding arms around the four kids.
Yeah.
Two boys, two girls. Everybody's looking really bright and happy. It could, you know, if I were to guess where, it'd be like a photo on a deck by Thousand Islands, if I'm just going to say it.
No, but you're close. This is, I guess, the other side of Toronto. This was at Thunder Bay. You know, Thunder Bay has, you know, the Canadian Shield, and Thunder Bay itself has... kind of a famous mountain, Mount McKay, it's called. It's an old volcano, whatever those things are called. And you can go up to the very top, and it's a beautiful look down at the city and at Lake Superior. It's an amazing place to go up to. And this photograph, I would say this is probably, like, my wife and I adopted all four of our kids. And we adopted the two eldest ones here first, Brandon and Leica. And the two younger ones here, Matthew and Roxana. We adopted later, and this is probably the first time that we drove out to Saskatchewan with the younger twins, with Matthew and Anna. So it was a really important trip because it was the first time that my siblings, I have many siblings, got to meet Roxana and Matthew, and you know, long trips in a car. I mean, they can be awful, but my wife and I tried to make it really enjoyable. Like, we didn't push ourselves every day. We would drive maybe 4 or 5 hours every day, and we'd stop almost every beach and take lots of photographs. So yeah, this is important because as I was saying, family is really important to me, and I love our kids, and adopting four older kids, you know, I mean, let's face it, if kids get adopted at an older age, it's because they've experienced some awful things, you know, that's taken
them,
you know, why they've been apprehended from their birth family. So all of our kids had trauma to deal with and things like that. And so, it was the hardest thing we have ever done in our lives by far, you know, sometimes close to just saying, oh, can we do this? You know, but we're both stuck, my wife and I. And, it's also the greatest thing that we have ever done. Because I was just saying this to somebody I work with today, you know, there's something about an adoptive, you know, relationship when it turns out well, and it always doesn't always, it's a special kind of bond because the parents know and the kids know that it didn't have to be, you know, that we chose them and they chose us. They were older kids, so they had a say in things.
Oh, wow.
And it's a really special kind of love, I think. No better or worse than any other kind of love, but it's a different kind of love, I think, than what is found between parents with their biological children. And I'm coming at this from another direction too, because my parents adopted kids and one of my sisters. So it's sort of, it's built into my DNA, so to speak. You know, there's so many kids in Ontario right now. How many people are in Ontario? 6 million or something like that. At any given time, there are about 10,000 children who are crown wards, you know, and the older ones rarely will get adopted. I mean, they'll grow up in, in institutions or foster homes, things like that, and they won't have parents. And that is so hard to, it's so hard to thrive in that kind of situation.
No, of course. So, you know, like, here's the joy for me of this podcast is I don't know who I'm going to meet. Yeah. I don't know where the conversation is going to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these bombs kind of land. And like one of them is, you know, you started off, you mentioned the landscape of growing up in the prairies. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, my brain was kind of like, okay, I kind of think I know where we're going. Mm-hmm. And then it happens always that, you know, the photographs are interesting. Like, it's like in your life, these are like signposts or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, and then as an external person for myself who reads into this photo. And so as you're telling this story, which says so much about you and, okay, first of all, what's your wife's name? Are we allowed to say?
Oh, yeah. Melanie. Yeah.
Okay. So Melanie and you are a special kind of couple, special kind of people, because to adopt older kids, whoa, that's like, that's intense. And so in this photograph, yeah, like when I look at it at first, I say, okay, I see four kids, everybody's smiling, looks really warm. Yep. And then, so the younger kids are twins, mm-hmm. and I would have guessed twins. Yep. And then, because, you know, they have certain common features, and there's this closeness. It's a really intense photograph. Yeah. And then there's you telling what's around that. Yeah, like, Mark, this is a strong way to start the conversation.
That's good. Yeah.
Okay. So, but you also said you're a teacher at the university and you teach English.
Yeah. Well, I used to teach English literature, 16th century English literature. And then, some years ago, I switched over to work in a teaching center. So my job for the past number of years has been to help professors learn how to teach more effectively, you know, because most of them don't get any training, you know, they're just dropped down into a classroom and said, here, teach. So, they want to learn, they want to become as good at teaching as they can. And so that's what I do.
Which says a lot about what your brain is like, what kind of person you are. Just in terms of, you know, I asked you the simple question, well, what does photography mean to you? And I'm like, here comes the train, boop, boop, and then you come in. And I'm just like, okay, Mark, you know, like, whoa, you know, it's just, and what's beautiful is that you're covering this incredible ground. Now, I want to say, how many dogs do you have in your house?
We have four dogs.
Ah, me too. What is it, Canadians with four dogs? Okay.
Yeah.
So I assume you said that your wife and kids may be arriving, and when they do, I might hear some barking. Yeah.
This is them arriving now. So it'll probably take them another 2 minutes to get in. And
all good. All good. So we can either stay on this photo, stay on this topic, if you want to say a bit more about this really, I mean, profound. You know, most humans, most couples, most parents, most families aren't like yours.
No.
And so what's that switch in your brain that says, okay, let's adopt two kids. And then, oh, let's adopt two more kids.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember, I mentioned, I grew up with adopted brothers.
Yeah.
And in fact, we're First Nations or Indigenous brothers. When I grew up, you know, they were still... The term Indian was still used, yep. but not sure. anymore in Canada. And now, I mean, that's come to be known as the 60s scoop, you know, and the government, swooped in and in lots and lots of cases, inappropriately took Indigenous children from their Indigenous parents. At the same time, again, because of 400 years of oppression and cultural genocide and things like that, Indigenous communities were struggling with raising their children. Yeah. And so people like my parents, you know, amazing people, the best people I've ever known. I mean, they've passed away now. But I asked my mom once, and I remember it was my father had actually just gone into emergency at the hospital because he had tachycardia. So his heart rate was at over 200 beats per minute. And we thought he was going to die. And I don't know why I said to my mom, so why did you and dad, what made you decide to adopt children? And her answer was so simple. It just blew me away. She said, because there was such a need, you know? So I thought, oh man, that's, how can you have a better response than that? And so that's, I think, what motivated
my wife and I, just that need, trying to help.
Yeah.
Well, I'll mention one other thing too. Like my wife grew up as a Mennonite. And are you familiar with Mennonites?
No.
Well, I'll say a little bit about it. It falls into the broader category of Anabaptist Christians. And Mennonites traditionally have been very service oriented. You know, social justice is incredibly important to them. Pacifism. For many centuries, they were also persecuted, you know, run from one country to another in Europe. And some eventually had to go to South America. And then some came to Canada, of course. And so that aspect of being Mennonite, you know, when I married into her family and, you know, we started going to a Mennonite church, I also found being Mennonite and the values of being Mennonite to be really, really conducive to myself. That idea of being a servant to others. And if we can help, we have to help, you know?
Right.
Downstairs on our wall, one of our kids, I think it's our youngest kid, wrote on a chalkboard, she said, if you can't help 1,000, just help one, you know?
Right.
Just start someplace. Don't let yourself feel overwhelmed.
Right. Now, I'm going to take that as the perfect segue to, first of all, it's a beautiful statement. Such a beautiful statement. And we could totally get lost. Not lost. We could totally get immersed in all of that. But we have to talk. We have to look at the next photo.
Okay, let's do that.
Oh, this is great. I love this. Okay, so yes, you've been making photographs a long time.
Yeah.
So it's a photograph of... So the colors are all a little bit tweaked with Photoshop or filters or whatever. But there's this beautiful black youngish dog, probably like 1 or 2 or 3 years old.
Yeah.
With a pink collar.
Yeah.
And it's like a I don't know if it's a purebred, but it looks like a nice black, beautiful mongrel, all black. But the hair is kind of silvery because of the way the photo has been exposed.
Exactly. Yep.
And then that's in the foreground. And in the background is like a wicker couch.
Mm-hmm.
And on the wicker couch is this sweet little girl who's perfectly framed under the jaw of this dog.
Yeah.
Mark Morton, what is this? Beyond being a fantastic image,
what is this? Thank you. Yeah, I like it too. Well, this is our dog, Layla. And you're right. She was about 3 years old at this time. And sort of under her chin in the background is our daughter, Roxana. And I love it as a photograph, like as a quote unquote work of art, let's say, because of the colors and because of how Layla the dog's fur is so black that it becomes blue almost, you know?
Yeah. And silvery too, with how it catches the light.
Yeah.
And yeah, but yeah, almost blue. You're right.
And her gaze, you know, you can see her eye, what she was looking out the window at. And I like how there's such a definite foreground and background in it.
Yep.
And that kind of framing, I mean, those are the kind of moments that I look for, because I love to go through the world every day looking for wonder, you know, looking for
moments
of wonder. And they're all around us all the time. But we have to pause and let ourselves see them, let ourselves find them. And yeah, camera can help one do that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't point, I have to interrupt just a second, because what I didn't point out is, so you've got the bluish black, bluish silvery black of your dog.
Yep.
And then in the background, your daughter is wearing a yellow t-shirt.
Yep.
And then she's got socks with these like pink tips on the toes, which are echoed in the pink of the collar of your dog.
I never noticed that.
And then the wall is yellow, just like the t-shirt.
Yeah.
Then there's the wicker, which is kind of brown and warm. Mm-hmm. And then there's like the small, you can just see the hints of a small either stepladder, step foot thing or stool or something. And you, as you say, the your dog's gaze, Layla, right?
Layla.
The gaze is just neutral and open and looking forward. And it's just, as an image, it's stunning.
Mm-hmm.
And then knowing, well, you know, your dogs are rescues, I assume.
Yes, they are, yeah. And, you know, the other thing is that
just connecting this back to our four adopted children, like my wife and I always had four dogs, even before we adopted kids. But after we adopted kids, we realized how important, well, two things, absolutely crucial. Anytime we're asked to talk to people who are thinking about adoption, I say there's two things. One is take lots of photographs because you have to make up those memories and then look at the photographs with the kids, you know, constantly. The other thing is having dogs, because dogs, unconditional love, and also with four kids, four dogs, each of our kids felt like he or she could adopt one of the dogs. You know, original dogs are, you know, have passed by, but we've replaced them with new ones.
Yeah.
But we owe such a debt to those dogs. Like I come close to tearing up when I think about how much we owe them in helping our kids get over so much trauma, so much PTSD.
Yeah. So in terms of this set, or actually across the podcast, there have been a few people, like, a good cluster of people who have brought photos of their dogs into the episodes. And then I absolutely, and this is good. This is actually really, you're exactly the right person to answer this question. Okay. So there's this sense of, in a way, there's a simplicity. Like, people who don't have dogs just think a dog's a dog. It's all the same. Yeah. But you and I all know, you and I both know that each dog is a completely different being unto itself. Yep. Totally different personality, totally different character, all the important big stuff. And yet, simplified in a way that is so therapeutic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so, believe it or not, that's my question.
Yep.
Take it from there.
I totally agree. Like, not just for like kids of all sorts, adopted kids or non-adopted kids, but also at the other end of things with elderly people. We have gone to some residences for elderly people, different stages of needing care. And some of the homes, some of these residences had a dog in them. And it was just so great. You know, the elderly people, most of them anyway, they just love having a dog around.
Yep.
And we also, with one of our dogs, with one of our first dogs, Eccles, we took her to a program offered by St. John's Ambulance, in which the dog gets assessed in order to see if we could take the dog into senior citizens' residence.
Right.
So that, you know, they can interact. And
you need the right character.
Exactly. And usually what St. John's Ambulance is concerned about is a dog being sufficiently calm and gentle. Well, they decided that Eccles was too calm. They wanted an animal that was a little bit more, I don't know. I think she would have done a great job, but, you know, that was that. But yeah, I say often to people that I really believe this. I think a big part of the reason why we are here as humans on this planet, in this universe, is for dogs, and dogs for us.
Okay.
I think one of the great, I mean, I'm going to say humans invented dogs, and I know that wolves, we didn't invent wolves and so on, but we did invent dogs in the sense that we domesticated them over the course of tens of thousands of years. And it's the best thing we've ever done. You know, it's the best that humans have ever done.
Because of what what you had said earlier, and the direction that I was projecting, I thought you were going to say service. And in a way, like, so what you don't know about me is that a big part of my life has been to train and teach and coach on this thing called service network leadership, right? In a professional sense. And we don't mean that service is like customer service. We mean that service is the energy between two people. So a newborn gives a newborn service. A dog gives a dog service. And a child gives a child service back to the dog. So Your home is a service network, and it's got its own dynamics. And so how much of your world and life, because of your children, is like a kind of a I don't want to say mediator, but a kind of a guide. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're guiding them.
Yeah.
And I'm dogs as well as your children, as well as yourselves, to navigate, right? Through your days and your conditions and the growth.
Well, I would say that all parents do that, of course. But again, the thing about adopting older kids is they've been through so much, and then there are other complexities that I haven't referred to, which things like one of our adopted children has wanted and continues to want to be in touch with his biological family. Or certainly his biological grandparents. Mm-hmm. And so you get these complexities.
Yep.
It's not just it becomes like not just a network, but sometimes like a snakes and ladders game, you know, trying to navigate all these things. And it's hard for everybody. It's hard for our kids because Matthew wants to be in touch and has been in touch with his birth family, and his birth sister, Roxana, doesn't want to have anything to do with them. You know, and so that can create tension mm-hmm. between them. So, I mean, one good thing is that my wife has training as and has worked as a mediator, as a conflict resolution.
Okay.
You know? Oh, and wow. So she's got lots of skills that I don't think I have.
You Amazing. Know,
which have been really helpful in guiding the kids through things, because it's so easy yep. to fall into old patterns of dealing with challenges or conflict, you know, which is often just escalation, you know.
Yeah.
And finding new patterns is hard, but I mean, it's the only way forward.
Well, Mark, so right now it's evening for you, it's yep. morning for me. You know, like last week's episode was full on. So first of all, no, I want to say congratulations and welcome, because this is season 5, so Excellent. You're one of the first episodes Great. In season 5. You're blowing my mind. Aha! Okay, yeah. So just like the other image, I love the play of composition, right? So the previous image had really interesting composition. And the colors were a little bit mm-hmm. fantastic, right? Because it's not a purely representative of how we see with our eyes, you know, in the mm-hmm. regularly. And then in this photo, it's a photo of a reflection mm-hmm. of a window. And so you can just barely see the window frame. It's like double glass window. So the reflection is really nice and bright. Outside is super mm-hmm. sunny. The sky is blue. There are these white clouds. There's this tree that's got no leaves on it, so this must yep. be spring, yep, I imagine. And it's the reflection of a backyard of sorts, because there's like a, sort of a railing, like a sort of, for maybe vine leaves. It's hard to know what you're yep. really looking at. And you can just tell, like parasols, there's a deck, there are three people sit at a table, four people, a couple of parasols. It's a nice day. Maybe it's in Ontario. Who knows? What I love the fact that you chose it, and it's almost got this Dali-esque, surrealist kind of thing where your brain's like, okay, yep. what am I looking at? This doesn't make sense. It's very colorful. It's very playful. It's alive. It's bright. But it's also got this surreal element to it. Why and what?
Well, I think you've described it really, really well. What I like about it, I mean, I think a lot of people might look at this and go, what an awful photograph. Like, this is not a photograph of anything.
Nope. This is great. It's great.
What I like about it sort of at an abstract level or a conceptual level is there's all these layers in it. So you have the sky layer, you have the cloud layer, mm-hmm. you have the window itself layer. And then within the window, you've got the layer of the tree and the layer of the umbrellas, as you said. And I like that as an idea, because again, that's how I see life. You know, there are so many layers. No, we don't exist mm-hmm. Just on a single flat plane, Euclidean plane or anything like that. Every human has all kinds of layers, and sometimes we show these layers and sometimes these ones. Same kind of thing here. I mean, one can focus on this layer, or you can focus on a different layer. So it's kind of, to me, almost like an interactive photo. Because you can choose what mm-hmm. you want to focus on, what you want to see.
Like, you know, it's that whole thing of mirrors and windows. So what you've actually done is you made a photograph of a window, and the reality of the photograph is you can tell by the window frame that you can just make it out. But then there's that whole reality of, well, what's actually behind the reflection? And it's hard to tell what's in the room, you know? So I'm a shit host, because what I do is I interrupt my guests. So
it's a great back and forth. Well, this was actually in not far from Kitchener-Waterloo, where I am, is another city called Guelph. And Guelph is a beautiful, by Canadian standards, old city, you know? And the best thing, they've kept lots and lots of their beautiful old buildings, whereas Kitchener has, I think, not retained a lot of their architecture.
For the people who don't know Canada, who don't know whatever, Guelph, I haven't been to Guelph. Have I? I don't know. Maybe I've been. Do you know the etymology of the name?
A little bit. Like,
because it's the ugliest word, if you think about it.
It is.
Guelph. I just walked in the street and stepped in some Guelph.
It doesn't sound like it, but I believe it's actually Italian. And it goes back, to the Reformation, when there was two houses in Italy. I mean, houses in the sense of dynasties, sort of. There were the Guelphs and there were the Ghibellines. And one supported the Pope and one didn't support the Pope. I forget which one. And I think there's quite a number of people from Italy in Guelph. And, you know, this is a bit of a tangent, but it's really strange in Canada how some cities just attract people from one country, like Thunder Bay. I mentioned that earlier on. Thunder Bay has a tremendous proportion of people from Italy. You know, why they ended up there, I don't know. Winnipeg,
weird.
Tremendous number of people from Iceland. In fact, there are more people living around Winnipeg and in Manitoba from Iceland, like with Icelandic roots, than there are in Iceland. So anyways, that was just a little digression there.
That's very strange. Yeah. So back to the photo, if you like. So why did you choose this one? Other than the fact that it's got this amazing visual
layer. Well, that idea of layers is really important to me. Like sometimes I take photographs and they are just like, it's a nice image. You know, I don't take a lot of photographs of, I don't know, flowers or things like that, but sometimes it's just so beautiful. I like taking pictures of snow as well. And other times I take photographs because they are complex in an abstract way. And I like what they say about reality.
Where did you study?
Where did I study? I did my undergraduate at the University of Regina in Saskatchewan. And then for my master degree and PhD, I went to the University of Toronto. That's where I focused on 16th century non-dramatic English literature. And University of Toronto, the downtown campus, is also really nice because it has a number of beautiful old buildings, vine covered, you know. I really enjoyed that. And this was a cafe, actually, this photograph in Guelph.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Mark, your ex-professor, current professor, you're teaching teachers how to teach.
Yep.
You've done the long, difficult road of getting a doctoral, you know, doing the doctoral thesis which is a very lonely road, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very, that of the writer. Mm-hmm. So I know that there's that in your makeup. Mm-hmm. You're a visually oriented person, clearly, because your photographs just scream it. And so, so being a teacher or an instructor, either for your children or for your dogs or for graduates or for other teachers, is a service.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But, you know, can I throw one idea in here?
Please.
When you mentioned I'm visually oriented, I do like to think that I am, but I also have prosopagnosia, which is face blindness. Right.
Okay.
So if we met, you know, let's say we met in person, we could talk for 2 hours. Let's say I left and then we ran into each other in the street. I wouldn't recognize you. I can't remember faces.
Wow.
I can only remember faces with great difficulty and with very deliberate kind of piecing together.
Right.
somebody's face.
When did you get diagnosed with that? Like, what is all your life?
All my life. But the time that I started to notice it was when I was an undergraduate, and I started going to a lot of films, a lot of movies, and you know, so I'd be leaning over to the person I was with. So who's that? And they'd say, "Well, that's the main character." You know, the main character had gone off screen and come back dressed in something else, and I wouldn't recognize them.
Huh.
So I knew that there was something odd. And then there was the writer and psychiatrist, Oliver Sacks. You know, his best known book is The Man Who Mistook His Wife for His Hat.
Yeah.
He wrote about very interesting, curious neurologically atypical people. And he himself had, he's passed away now, he had prosopagnosia. And so that's where I first learned that this was an actual thing.
Yeah.
And so I did some research and I realized that that's what I have. I mean, it's harmless. I mean,
what a great way to describe it. It's harmless. It's not like I go on the street and I want to punch somebody's face. I love it. Now, here, when I was in my 20s, I was run over by a car and I had a very severe brain injury.
Yeah.
So after the hospital and after I was out of the rehab center, my girlfriend and I at the time went to see a movie, right? So just your story kind of reminded me of mine. So we went to see a movie. And in my case, because I had such a severe brain injury, when I went to go watch the movie, for the first five minutes, I had like an inability to decode what was on the screen.
Yeah.
So the music was way too loud and the light was too bright. And I was like looking at the screen and I couldn't, my brain just could not see what was there. Mm-hmm. And you know, like we used to have these like illusion, like visual illusion things that you'd stare at it for like these 3D illusions. And then if you stare at it long enough, all of a sudden you could see what it was.
Yeah. The stereoscopic things.
Yeah. Yeah. So in my case, it was the same similar thing where I was just like, what's going on? And she's like, Michael Douglas is on the screen. I was just like, Michael Douglas. So not what you have at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So as a professor, as a teacher, how does that manifest?
Well, I always would have my students, they'd be sitting at their tables or desks, and I would tell them to make a little name tent and then write their name on it. And so, different kinds of strategy. Another thing too, is I'm really good at recognizing voices.
Okay.
So often somebody will pass me or see me and there's subtle cues, like they'll raise their eyebrows. And so I'll be thinking, okay, so this person must know me. And I'll say, oh, hi, how are you doing? And then they'll speak and I'll go, oh, okay, this is Jonathan, you know?
Right, right.
I mean, if somebody has very noteworthy something, and if they have a big beard or something like that, or hoops in their ears, things like that, that helps. But if they don't, it's very, very, I was dating my now wife for months before I could recall what she looked like in my head.
Dude, that is the stuff of, so do you say Borges or do you say Borges or how do you say?
I think it's Borges. It's with a G.
Borges.
B-O-R-G.
Borges. So what you just described of not, I don't know if it's Gabriel Garcia Marquez or if it's a Borges sort of short story, but it's got that feeling to it of like, I dated her for a few months before I really got a sense of what, if I could actually remember what she looked like.
Yeah.
So is it that you, oh man, Mark, you, just like, so, okay. Yeah, okay. But like you, what a trip. Like, okay. So for, as far as your kids then, how does that manifest for them? How do you explain it to them?
I don't know if I ever did actually sit. I mean, they know the word prosopagnosia and face blindness. I've said that to them, but I don't think I ever sat them down and said, you know, you ought to know this about me. When I'm with somebody long enough, years, I mean, I recognize our kids now, but what sometimes happens too, let's say some extended family members on my wife's side, if I'm trying to think of one of her cousins, an image of someone will come into my head and I will know that it's not the right person. But I will also know that that person kind of resembles the other person in a way. And often it can be in a really subtle way, like a similar shaped head or something like that. And I'll try and try, and I just can't shake the wrong image. You know, I have to kind of stop trying.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, I'll answer that question in a different way, because, like I say, this is a harmless condition, if that's the right word to have, prosopagnosia. But it is a neurological atypical, or an atypical neurology or something like that. But my eldest son, Brandon, he has Asperger's syndrome. And so, you know, we talk about how he is atypical, you know, because I think that's right. The best way of, you know, calling a spade.
That's it.
And so I think it's been helpful in that way. And he has such gifts too. I mean, I think I have some gifts that I wouldn't have if I didn't have prosopagnosia. Like I think some parts of my brain that maybe normally would be devoted to recognizing faces, I use for other things, you know?
Absolutely.
And Brandon is like that too. He's got a tremendous memory for facts and culture.
Yeah.
Loves to learn words in other languages and things like that.
That's fantastic.
And all of our kids, you know, well, I guess every kid, but, you know, I think our kids maybe a bit more than others are neurologically atypical. So our daughter Rika is an amazing artist, an amazing visual artist. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, is this your photograph? It's a panoramic shot.
Yeah.
So is this of the prairies that you mentioned earlier?
It is.
Big sky.
Yep. This is
just amazing.
But it's not the part of Saskatchewan where I grew up. Where I grew up, everything is flat. I mean, here, as you can see in this photograph.
Slight rolling hills.
Yeah. But it's about a 2.5 hour drive from where I grew up. And it's an area that's known as the Big Muddy.
Okay.
And there's not really farming there. There's mostly ranching. It's famous in history, this part of Saskatchewan, because it's where outlaws like Jesse James and, I don't know, Billy the Kid, when things got too hot for them, you know, down in South Dakota and so on, they would come up, cross the border into what is now Canada. They would hide out here, and you can actually take a tour, and you can find these caves where these outlaws hid. It's
really wow.
But I mean, the main thing is, this is beautiful. I mean, this is like,
it's, yeah, there's something. Okay. So basically the way it's shot is it's almost 50-50 of sky and land. The land is kind of this sort of brown grass, and it's very gentle rolling hills, very, very gentle. You can just make out a road, like a dirt road that's kind of snaking through, this one part. The sky is this perfect blue, and it's got some slightly cumulus white clouds. It's very dramatic. It's very contrasty. It's done. It's probably shot late morning, or, you know, it's high, not quite high noon, well, maybe high noon, because the clouds, the shadow is basically of a sun that's way above, just pretty much straight over the clouds.
Yeah,
it's a really great shot. So, you know, here's the question I'm asking myself, Mark. I think we were introduced by your publicist.
Is that possible? I think so. Yeah. Mickey.
Yeah. So, okay. So the question now I have to ask, do you have a book, or do you have a record, or do you have, what are you publishing? What are you trying to promote? How can we get people to learn more about you?
I'm just happy to talk, but yeah, I guess the premise for this chat with you is I recently published a young adult dystopian novel set in Northern Ontario called The Headmasters. And,
Mark, you buried the lead. What are you doing? What have you done?
I mean, the dogs again, just barking for a second.
It's all good. It's all good. Okay. If I may help you, what is the name of your book that we would like people to get?
It's called...
Whoa! Hi, pup.
It's called The Headmasters. And the premise, it's actually got a lot to do with memory. The premise is these creatures appear and become attached to the back of humans and insert sort of coils into their brains. And so for about 18 hours a day, they have control of humans, but 6 hours a day, they don't. And the headmasters have been around for about 60 years. And every time, you know, one human dies, that headmaster gets passed on to a new human. And I guess by accident or something, or it's not intended, the memories from that first host also get passed on to the next host.
Ah, right.
And so there's like this accumulation of memories that that happens. So yeah, the novel is about memory, and it's about a young female protagonist. She's 12 when the novel begins and about 20 when it ends. And her her struggle to overcome these creatures by drawing upon some memories that she's acquiring. Yeah.
That's so fascinating. Like, okay. So is this your first book? First novel? Not your first book, because you've but is this your first novel?
Yes, my first novel. But yeah, I wrote
congratulations.
Books of nonfiction before. Yeah, it felt really good. I mean, I've written another novel since then. I've completed one, but I haven't started sending it out to publishers or agents yet. And I've started a third one. And they're all, what I like they're all quite different from each other.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. First of all, what's great about your name is it's very memorable. Mark Morton. Mark Morton. Easy to remember. Mark Morton, you wrote a book. Your novel is out.
I'll just tell you one other thing about my name. Sometimes people by accident or intentionally, they're emailing me or writing me a letter, and they will leave out the T in my last name. And it's an important T, as you can
see.
Because without the T, Dr. Moron.
yes.
That has happened.
I'm sure you've gotten some good mileage out of that one.
Yep. Yep. But sorry,
okay. No, listen, man, we're just talking. We're just talking. Yeah. You got this novel out. You're clearly not a so it's one thing to study 16th century literature.
Mm-hmm.
And then to really dive deep into that.
Yeah.
For your PhD, and then to kind of say, okay, well, I'm going to go and do a different kind of writing, which is going to be more of a novel.
Yeah.
And why did your brain shift to go from nonfiction into fiction, into creating new worlds?
Two reasons. One was, you know, having raised these four kids and reading lots of stories to them and eventually reading with them lots of young adult fiction and really getting into that genre. And I think, you know, in particular, the Hunger Games, you know, I read that with the kids and I thought, wow, this is really, really good. I wish I could write this. The other thing was that as one gets older, I'm pretty sure you're not there yet. I'm 60, turned 60, 2 months ago. And again,
happy birthday.
Memory changes. I don't have the memory that I used to have. Like, to write the kinds of nonfiction books that I wrote required me to keep track of a lot of data and information in my head all at the same time. I can't do that anymore. But on the other hand, I think, you know, it's kind of like an impressionist painting. You know, when you're really close, you can see all the little dots, all the little pointillism stuff. But when you step back, you can see the bigger picture. And that's kind of what I feel like has happened to me. I don't have that really retentive memory anymore, but my imagination and my ability to think of stories at a big level, I think, has improved.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay,
yeah, I think that's why I shifted to fiction. Yeah.
It's interesting to me that you know you see the task of my podcast, which is send me four photos that will frame the conversation. Great. And some people overthink it.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, and then what I usually say is, you know, even if you don't know what to pick, just pick whatever, because ultimately it's from your life and it's going to be a reflection of what's important to you. So in your case, I don't know what process you went to. And it's funny how your novel is almost like this. It's like this thing that was like, where I was like, hey, you know, can we put a spotlight on that. But okay, so first photo is of you with your yep. four kids, and that opened an incredible mm-hmm. door. The second photo is of, you know, one of yep. your four dogs and the connection to your mm-hmm. to your kids. Another like amazing mm-hmm. Door. Then there's the photo of the reflection showing, like, I think it, in a weird way, it represents, or it opened the door really to how you mm-hmm. see people, right? Like your interface yep. on people, right? Like in terms of how you construct a person's identity more by voice mm-hmm. than by sight, mm-hmm. perhaps, mm-hmm. I don't know. And then the last photo is of mm-hmm. the sky, the big sky. But yeah, so how do we turn that sort of narrative into mm-hmm. as an instructor, mm-hmm. right? As a teacher, what do we give next? So one, I'm telling yeah. people to go get your book, but also in terms of your narrative, in terms of your little yeah. story right now, how do we kind of wrap it up so that a person goes like, ah, got it.
Well, again, I'll take two different approaches to this. One is, you know, you described the sequence of four photographs that we looked at. And yet I think also if we had looked at them in a different sequence, I suspect our conversation would have gone in different directions. And, you know, so, I mean, that's absolutely one of the great things about conversations is how they can take different directions. In terms of, I don't know, sort of a through line or a, I don't know, moral of the story kind of thing. I guess it, to me, it's all about relationships, you know, and that can be relationships yep. with family members. With the last photograph of Saskatchewan, it's my relationship with that land, with that kind of topography. That's really important to me. I lived in Ontario for mm-hmm. 20 years, but I still miss the prairies so much. I miss that land that I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
And with the more abstract one, the window reflection, you know, the relationships between the different layers within the photograph. And then the one with the dog, with Layla, yeah, it's that relationship with, I guess, the non-human. But I mean, I don't want to, that almost makes it sound like they are lesser, but relationship with different kinds of creatures.
Yeah.
And I mean, lots of people love cats. I like cats too. But to me, there's something about dogs that, as you were saying earlier, every dog is different, and the relationship one can establish with a dog, every dog, is different.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. That's mm-hmm. what I love about them. I mean, dogs are just pure. You know, what you see is what you get. And we yeah. learn a lot from them.
No, for sure. Okay, so, Mark, the title of your book one more time, please. The Headmasters, available on your website.
Say headmasters, in British schools, you know, they have a headmaster. Here it's kind of, not a pun really, but, you know, because yep. they are attached to people's heads.
This has been really great. It's always going to school with my guest, right? Like, okay, what am I going to learn about this time? And first of all, respect, brother, fellow Canadian. This is great. I think that is something that is, as I said before, you know, the mm-hmm. cadence of how you speak, mm-hmm. your accent, you know, what you talk about, where your attention is.
I agree.
So very Canadian. And it's great. It's comforting. Any last bit of wisdom you'd like to hand over? For me, the one bit of wisdom is to go get your book. That's it.
Or not. If your listeners would rather go take photographs, do that. You know, do whatever is going to feel meaningful to you. I hope people read my book, but more than that, I hope people just find meaningful things to do in their lives. I want to say too, I've loved this conversation. This is exactly the kind of chat that I love to have. And if you're ever in this neck of the woods in Canada, let me know and we'll go for coffee or tea or something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, I've hitched through Kitchener, past Kitchener a bunch. Look, have a really great evening. You're a good, you know, in the sense of good, like you're a good man. You and your thank wife you. Are good people. Your families are
thank you.
Great family. And thank you so much for sharing.
I've really loved it. Okay. Thanks, Rand. Okay. Take care.
Shooting it raw?
Yes. Shooting it raw. Ooh, baby, I like